Man, that PC life is...
Yeah, are you a Mac guy?
I am, but I'm going to have to buy a new one soon. Mine's from 10th grade of high school. So, well, there's only one 10th grade, but it was from high school, and it's still kicking. But
yeah.
It's towards the end of its life.
I don't know if that says a lot about the Mac or...
A little about me.
Welcome to another episode of Jabber and the Drone, the movie review podcast that politely disagrees to agree. I am Cassidy Robinson, and I'm here in North Hollywood. I am bringing on a guest.
Hi, I'm Alec Ingerson, friend of Cassidy from college, I suppose.
Yeah, I met you, what, last year?
The year before? 2 years ago, I think, right? In my senior year of college, so was that 2 years ago?
I think I met you mostly in our cult cinema class.
Right.
And so. you were like the young, wiry guy with a lot of opinions.
I am still that, I think. A little less young, perhaps.
And, yeah, you were an undergrad and we were grad students, so we're clearly too cool for school.
Right.
But, you still hung out with us anyway. We allowed you to hang out with us.
I was, granted, permission, like a special pass.
You're an honorary grad.
Honorary grad student.
Right.
Until I apply, I guess, to actual grad school.
Right. But, and I ran into you last week.
Right.
At, Stanley's Kamikaze.
Right. Yeah, out by the food trucks.
Yeah. Uh-huh. I don't know if a lot of people know what Kamikaze is. It's basically like, it's a comic convention. It's a smaller one. It's a newer one. And it's over in, downtown LA
by the Staples Center.
Right. Yeah. And, you were in cosplay.
True. As Theodore Twombly from, Spike Jonze's Her. I, rocked the mustache. It took forever to grow it, but I rocked the mustache and the high waisted pants and the glasses. Yeah.
We got it immediately.
Yeah, you were one of the few, but yeah.
Well, it's not exactly Comic-Con kind of
dress. Kamikaze is an odd place, though. It's kind of like Comic-Con light, you know?
And yeah.
Whenever the convention's smaller, I kind of hope for people to be, you know, more passionate. Not that mine was at all comic book reference, but a few people got it. I was kind of impressed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like 1 year, I always have these ideas for Halloween costumes, but since I've moved here, I never go through with them.
Hmm.
Because of one reason or another, but I think the year before last, I was going to go to school, actually. I was going to go to Chapman, dressed as Peter Lorre from M.
Mm.
It's an easy costume. Yeah. All I had to do, I already had a black overcoat. I wrote M on the back of it with a piece of chalk, and I bought a, costume fedora.
Yeah.
And then, all day, nobody else was dressed up, and we weren't going to do anything afterwards, so I was like, well... No reason to waste a costume.
Right. I showed up to work in my costume, actually, the Friday before Halloween. I was very committed to the Halloween costume.
It's kind of work appropriate.
Oh, yeah.
It's not like you were dressed as, I don't know, Priscilla Queen of the Desert or something like that.
That'll be next year. I'll do that. A few people were cautious of the mustache. No one particularly likes the mustache look for me, I think. Maybe particularly.
I don't know if it aged you or not. It did something.
It made me look like I was interested in people that weren't my age.
That's a long way of saying that.
Yeah, it was a pedophilic kind of.
Where did you find such high-waisted pants? Did you wear those like normal pants or you just like pulled way high?
I own those pants already and I'm just cursed with ridiculously high hips, and so all my that was actually me wearing them at appropriate height for my
cursed or blessed.
I think it's a curse. When I'm sitting, I'm significantly shorter. I appear much shorter. I'm actually about 5'11", maybe.
You know what?
Six.
That's very true.
Yeah,
that's very true because I think we sat together a lot during cult cinema, and I always assumed you were really short. But then when we walk side by side,
yeah,
you're like my height or taller.
Yeah, it's a dwarfish body. My actual torso is quite tiny.
Well, this podcast started off really strange.
Hopefully it continues to be strange.
Hopefully. Today we're going to be talking about the new Bond movie, Spectre.
Right.
And in the Netflix homework, we're going to review what you assigned, The Five Venoms.
Right.
A Shaw Brothers movie.
Shaw Brothers, yep. Run Shaw. Yeah, I kind of wanted to pair Spectre with a different form of action. You know?
Yeah.
That's why my list of you is all kind of out of the norm.
Right. I always ask for 3 to 5 picks in case there's something we've already seen, so I don't have to keep asking.
Mm-hmm.
And usually that's enough to grab something. And yeah. They were all like, I saw a trend.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, like martial arts movies, kind of schlocky.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I saw that one in particular, I was like, ooh, that's like from the 70s and everything. We have to do it.
Yeah. Hopefully it brings up some cool points to talk about when we get to Spectre.
I think so, yeah. But before that, let's go ahead and get on to our movie news. We didn't do a show last week,
okay,
which is entirely my fault. It usually is. I think Richard, if he were here, he would concur that when we don't do a show, it's usually my fault.
What did you do? What happened?
Kamikaze happened, and then it was one of those things where I was like, oh, well, I'll watch the movies this day, and it'll be fine, and then it ended up not being fine, and entirely my fault. No good excuse.
Right.
So, because of that, we have a lot of backed-up movie news we're gonna pick from. I want to remind listeners, if you like our Facebook page, facebook.com/JabberPodcast, you can see all the other news stories that we don't talk about. And comment on those if you wish.
You're good about that. You post a lot of.
I news. Do.
Yeah.
I think that if a listener were to follow our Facebook, that it would be like a really good deal because then you don't have to like follow each individual blog or each individual trade. Right. You get the basic cool stories of the week in one source. Okay, well, let's start here since you seemed like you had a lot to say about it. Alicia Vikander, am I pronouncing it right?
I couldn't tell you. Alicia Vikander?
She was the star of Ex Machina.
Yeah.
She played the Robo Girl.
She's great.
And she was in a few other movies this year as well.
Yeah, she did,
what was that called? I don't remember.
I can't remember.
Anyways.
She was in the spy film with Henry Cavill and Man from U.N.C.L.E.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
you're right.
She was good. I like that film.
I didn't catch Man from U.N.C.L.E., actually. It was one of those things where it's like, four things came out that week, and I had to pick one.
Right, of course.
I mean, which I think that was a lot of people that week with that movie in particular.
Yeah. I mean, it's not, you know, it wasn't a 10 out of 10 top of the list, but I thoroughly enjoyed it, you know. We were spoiled now. There's so many good movies all the time. That,
right.
That, like, average movies or slightly above average movies tend to become under the radar kind of things.
Mm.
Yeah.
But anyway, so she's coming onto the scene. She's kind of a big deal now and picking up a lot of roles really quickly. And it looks like she might replace Rooney Mara in the sequel to the remake of Girl with the Dragon Tattoo.
Right.
What exactly do you have to say about this? They're calling this Girl in the Spider's... Girl in the Spider's Web, which isn't... Girl Who Plays with Fire or Girl Who Kicks a Hornet's Nest, so I don't know if it's an adaptation of either or both of those, or if they're just doing something new altogether.
Yeah, that's odd. I actually hadn't heard about the title change. I have just kind of odd feelings about this in general. Fincher, I heard, is not coming back, is the belief. That's what bothers me more than anything, I think. I'm actually not as vocally against reboots and, reimaginings and all that kind of jazz as a lot of my contemporaries are.
Right.
I'm actually pretty all right with it. I think in this particular case, knowing Fincher wanted to do it for so long and knowing that Craig and Rooney Mara wanted to do it for so long, it seems odd to me that they're pulling it away.
Yeah.
My only belief on why they would do something like that and pull it away is because someone else has agreed to do it, maybe PG-13 or cheaper, and I know Fincher was very adamant about how he controlled the project, and inevitably it ended up not making as much money as they wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was about a $70 million R-rated film. And
it underperformed.
Yeah, and I mean, it's hard. R-rated movies are hard to sell to studios a lot of the time.
Yeah, and they release it on Christmas week.
Right, the feel-bad movie there, which was great. I mean, I thought the whole marketing campaign was fantastic.
Yeah.
But...
I'm kind of mixed on the Fincher Dragon Tattoo. I think it's beautifully made, and it's made like a Fincher film, so
right.
being done with a lot of attention to detail, and it's super atmospheric. But it was one of the I am one of those people who, like, if there's a remake or something, and it's completely unnecessary.
Mm-hmm.
The Girl with the Dragon Tooth, the Swedish version, had only been out for, like, 2 years at mm-hmm. that point. And I think that's a pretty dang good film. I was excited to see what Fincher would do with it, and he certainly did it his way, but I also felt like the story beats were just so similar that right. It was like deja vu.
Mm-hmm. If I remember correctly, and I totally could be wrong, but I believe the Fincher film and the Swedish film were actually kind of started around the same time, and Fincher's film just took much longer to actually finish. That could be not true, but I had heard that they began development around similar times.
Development, probably.
But, of course, filming. And
yeah, because I think, like, at the time the Swedish version came out, that's when he was either working on or had just released Social Network.
Mm.
Yeah, that would have timeline-wise been right. about right. But anyway, yeah, I guess, you know, this version, the Alicia Vikander version, yeah, would be completely recast. Amy Pascal and Scott Rudin from Sony are producing.
That's crazy.
Yeah, I don't know.
I mean, Sony just in general this year has been a complete yeah. mess. I'm surprised Amy Pascal is still working. I probably shouldn't say that. I'm going to get in so much trouble. I mean, Sony's year has been unbelievably terrible. Their top three movies all have Kevin James in them, and they're all produced by Adam Sandler. And,
right.
If there's actually in their top 25, a bunch of them are just leftovers from last year that made like $50,000, $60,000, but that's enough to be in the top 25 for Sony, which is, I mean, wow, it's a terrible year. Like,
yeah, they lost Spider-Man essentially. And
I mean, they might lose Bond now.
Yeah, that's we'll get to that when we talk about the new Bond film, but it looks like they're looking to break away and go back to being, I guess, an independent-ish property.
I mean, I don't think they can afford to be the blockbuster kind of syndicate that they tried to be, you know?
Right.
Anymore.
Yeah. So maybe they're hoping that this will put them back there.
Right, which is why I think it's going to end up being PG-13 or something along those lines. And
I never saw the other two. I saw Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, and I never saw the other two Swedish ones. But based upon what I know about that series, how is that even possible?
I couldn't tell you. But maybe that's why this is the girl with the spider or whatever it was called.
Right, rather than doing the other two adaptations.
Right. I actually think that the other...
Less murder rape.
Probably, or more blood-free murder, you know?
Sure.
But, I mean, I actually think that Girl Played with Fire and Kick the Hornet's Nest, the film versions from Sweden, are really bad. They're quite terrible. They were made for TV.
Yeah.
I actually don't even really like the original Girl with the Dragon Tattoo that much. I think it's really weirdly paced. I think Fincher is far superior.
I agree with you on the pacing, actually. I think both movies are a little too long.
Mm.
I think Fincher kind of smooths that out a little bit more, but maybe it's something about the roughness of the Swedish version that I'm kind of into.
I can totally see that. Roughness allows for mistakes in an area that can still make the film better as a whole. You know, once you see a general roughness, smaller mistakes become more forgivable. Like the film sets a tone for itself of being imperfect, and that makes it somehow better occasionally. For me.
Yeah, so it depends. It obviously depends, but yeah.
Totally.
Okay, this one's a little interesting.
Hmm.
So, the new trend in Hollywood, it seems, is the gender swapping.
Right.
We have a female Ghostbusters coming out.
Mm-hmm.
There's been talks about an Expendables for a really long time. We'll see if that ever gets off the ground.
Right.
So it isn't necessarily a gender swap so much as just kind of a, I don't know, I guess it's like the Chipettes and the versus Alvin and the Chipmunks.
Right.
Or
the Rowdy Rough Boys to the Powerpuff Girls.
Yeah, that's probably better.
Yeah.
And I guess the new one is George Clooney is looking to produce a reboot of Ocean's 11 with Sandra Bullock playing his part and an all-female Ocean's 11.
Right. How do you feel about that? First impression.
First impression. I don't know. Well, here's, I think less of a thing than just the gender issue of it, which for me is pretty much whatever. I don't care either way.
Right.
I'm more interested if it's going to be a good story. And if it's going to be a good story, don't tell the same story.
Mm.
you know, if you want to do a reboot, and I feel the same way with the Ghostbusters thing when it comes out. I could care less of that they're all women. In fact, that could be cool for a lot of different reasons. But I just don't want to see the same beats from that first movie, but done with new actors right. playing those characters. And that's I'm a little afraid that's what it's going to be. Right. And I feel the same way here about this Ocean's 11. If they just end up doing a different heist altogether, mm-hmm. and but the same basic idea of like a big group of people get together to pull off a heist,
right?
Then that could be a lot of fun. But if like, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I totally. I mean, I don't love this idea mainly because I don't really like Sandra Bullock. I think is like the main driving force behind my dislike for this. I don't think she's anywhere near the charm of Clooney. Not that there's not a female actor out there that could match that charm. There definitely is. It's really just the Bullock thing, I think, that's ruining it for me, or potentially ruining it. And I'm going to reserve my right to change my opinion on this story as it gets more developed and I learn more right. about it.
Actually, you're not alone. I feel like Sandra Bullock is one of those actresses that you either are really for or really against. I know very few people who are lukewarm about Sandra Bullock.
She started very interestingly. I think Speed's brilliant. I think Miss Congeniality is absolutely brilliant. And somewhere along the line, she just began to lose me. I couldn't stand mm-hmm. The Blind Side, and I could not stand Gravity.
I really like Gravity, but I'll give you The Blind Side. I would say I didn't see it, but it was when I was working at the video store, and I worked with a lot of people who really liked that movie. So I think I did see that movie, just not in the right order of scenes.
Right.
Would come in halfway through at various different points in the movie and kind of gather that it was really obnoxious and shrill.
I mean, I've done similar things. I used to work in a movie theater, so half-hour breaks. Go in, you catch about half hour of the movie, and then you try to piece your next breaks to catch different areas of it.
And you've pretty much seen the movie.
Yeah, it kind of reminds me of when I was younger before DVR and before I was hitting Blockbuster every day, where you would turn on the television and the movie that was on was what you would watch, and you just kind of you get thrown into the movie and you figure it out. You know? And some movies, I think, are aided by that. Fifth Element, I just rewatched, and having watched the beginning for the first time, and who knows how long, I was like, man, I don't need this. Throw me into it. I love that movie, but throw me in about 30 minutes in, and then just let me go.
Demolition Man was cool.
Oh, I love
She was cool in that.
Yeah, she's great, Demolition Man. I think she started very strong. And I don't think she's done necessarily only terrible things. I just think maybe she's... I don't know, something about her, she's kind of faded for me. Maybe the original appeal is lost, or maybe I just became used to her kind of stylings and I'm not impressed by them anymore.
Right. Yeah, I think... there's something about... I don't know, a lot of the roles that she's been taking. Obviously, she's done a lot of romantic comedies, and actually, I kind of point the marker at Miss Congeniality. It seems like that from that point on, she'd kind of been doing a version of that character in various different kind of plots.
Right.
Which is actually why I liked Gravity, is because it kind of seemed like a break from that. But yeah, I don't know. I don't necessarily have a problem with the idea of the movie. Just be a different story.
Yeah, I don't hate the idea of the movie. I mean, I would like Soderbergh to do it again, but then I start to think, well, if I really want everyone involved originally to do it again, then I'm just asking them to make the same movie, which I don't think is fair.
Right. But also, isn't Soderbergh, like, swearing off movies now? He's doing The Nick and...
Yeah. Soderbergh's an interesting cat. He, I think he would produce and maybe write, but I don't think he's interested in directing much anymore.
Yeah, I actually think he is involved as a producer on this project. So,
no, I'm sure.
Which makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, the paycheck would be great.
Yeah. Okay, last story.
Okay.
Rooney Mara and Nicholas Hoult, speaking of Rooney Mara,
right.
Are teaming up together to work on a film from the duo behind The One I Love.
Stoked. Love it.
Called The Discovery, which is, it's like a sci-fi romance that takes place in the future where they've been able to scientifically prove life after death.
Yeah.
That alone is an interesting hook. I want to know what's going on with that.
I'm totally on board. Did you see The One I Love?
Yes. It was it was in my top 10 of last year.
Oh, yeah. Me too. Yeah. I actually watched it this year, so it'd probably be my top 10 of this year. oh my gosh. Yeah, I was blown away by how brilliant I thought that movie was.
Yeah, it was like the best Charlie Kaufman movie that he never made.
Yeah. I mean, I love Charlie Kaufman. So I would put it maybe, I mean, yeah, it had a vibe. It wasn't, you know, it's no Being John Malkovich, but it's brilliant. I thought it was phenomenally put together. I knew nothing about it going in, so when I...
Yeah, and it's one of those movies, the less you know, the better it is.
Yeah, it just keeps unfolding, and you're fascinated by where you're going. And so...
It made it impossible to review for this podcast, but...
Oh, yeah, I can imagine. Stuff happened, and it was good. I don't want to tell you what happened, but the stuff that happened was good. No, I love this. Rooney Mara is great. You know, she just did Pan, which I didn't see, which was terrible, but...
Yeah.
I like her as an actress. I think she can kill it. I think Nick Holt has come like a really interesting way. I mean, when I saw him in Skins the first time, I was immediately fascinated by him.
Yeah.
As an actor, I think he has like a really great presence, and I like enjoy watching him on the screen. You know, he did a couple duds. I thought Jack the Giant Slayer was really terrible.
Yeah, that was super bad.
Not Nick's fault.
Probably no, not at
fault
all.
Of Bryan Singer, perhaps, but he's perfectly good in the X-Men films.
Mm-hmm.
He was fine in Warm Bodies for what that movie was.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. He actually was really game for what that movie was.
Yeah.
No, I agree with you. I think it's an interesting pairing. Funnily enough, Nick Holt, the first time I ever saw him was in About a Boy.
Hmm.
And he's like 11 or something, and he's like this chubby little moppet. And then the next, I didn't know, you know, whatever happened to that guy or whatever. I'm sure he did a lot of British television or whatever as he was growing up and coming out of puberty.
Right.
Obviously with Skins.
Right.
But the next time I saw him was in the Single Man.
Oh, yeah. Single
with,
Man.
With,
Colin Firth.
Colin Firth. Yeah.
Right.
And, I thought he was super interesting in that. And I really liked his, part in that. And then when I found out it was the same kid, I was like, yeah, you know, mind blown.
He's fantastic. I could talk about that movie for hours. I actually think that movie's unbelievably fantastic.
Yeah.
Tom Ford's first film, the second one's coming out soon. They just bought it for some ungodly amount of money from a festival.
Right.
Phenomenal movie, and he's great in it. I mean, Colin Firth, of course, is.
Yeah, everybody is really good in that. Yeah.
To act besides him is hard to do, and Nick Holt really kept his own in scenes with Colin Firth, which is a testament to how good of an actor Nick Holt really is.
Which would explain why he's in every casting rumor ever. For the last, like, 4 months.
Yeah, I heard he's going to be Batman, I think.
They're already going over Ben Affleck, just go straight to Nick Holt. You know what? He'd be a good Terry McGinnis. They want to do Batman Beyond.
He would be a good Terry McGinnis. That's a great idea. He could be really anyone, though, as far as I'm concerned. He could play any character. He's phenomenal.
But yeah, I'm interested to see how this sci-fi premise works out. The idea of like a love story angle or whatever, that may or may not be interesting, but I really want to know like what their version of the afterlife is. Is this going to be Flatliners? Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting. Flatliners. I've watched that movie since I was a kid. The afterlife in general is a very fascinating thing, even for people who aren't necessarily religious or believe in an afterlife. The idea of it is unbelievably fascinating.
Yeah, and the drama that you can dredge up from it is endless.
Oh, of course. And I love this like little resurgence of like middle budget sci-fi flicks. You know,
Ex Machina.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, the higher budget sci-fi flicks have been coming out, which is cool, but, you know, been less interesting to me than these lower to medium budgets. Ex Machina was great.
Yeah, I agree. Okay, and that's our movie news.
Cool.
We can go ahead and get into our first review, which is, as I said, the new Bond film.
Spectre.
Now, I don't know anything really about the Bond novels or...
Neither.
That they're based on. And I know a lot of the films were based on novels. Some of them aren't. Do you know if this one is or isn't?
I don't believe it's based on a novel. The title's too simple. The novel titles tend to be very...
Like 5 paragraphs long?
Yeah, you need more words. There's a word count, I think, for titles for James Bond.
Yeah. I know Casino Royale was based on a novel. I actually believe that was the first Bond novel. But I think all of the stuff with Daniel Craig has been sort of its own universe. It's almost kind of a soft reboot, in a way. This Daniel Craig era.
It is. It's
and the only one I haven't seen out of all of them is Quantum of Solace, but nobody says anything good about it.
Yeah, Quantum's. I mean, it's not good. it's a follow-up to a really great Bond film, mm-hmm. and just film, period, Casino Royale. And it's unbelievably disappointing to see where that story goes, you mm-hmm. know? Because they wanted to kind of, I think, tie it in. They wanted to kind of bring this overall message, make it a revenge film. But the James Bond revenge film's a little hard to swallow, I think, in the way they did it.
Right.
I was very disappointed by Quantum of Solace.
Yeah, as was most people.
Yeah.
But Skyfall did terrifically well.
True.
And Sam Mendes picked up the series, and Roger Deakins shot the last movie, and it was True. Absolutely gorgeous to look at. And I thought Skyfall was pretty great.
Yeah.
In fact, I actually came to Casino Royale late because I've never been a Bond person per se. I think I saw most of the Pierce Brosnan ones, and then I saw a couple on TV of the the older ones or whatever. And then everyone was telling me how I have to go out and see Casino Royale, and I just never caught up with it. And then I ended up seeing Skyfall probably to review it, and then I went back and watched Casino Royale. I've more or less really enjoyed this iteration mm-hmm. Of the Bond movies, and this one seems to follow in suit with at least those two films, especially Skyfall. Plot-wise, I guess what's going on here is this takes place a little bit after the events of Skyfall. So if you haven't seen it, spoiler alert, M died.
Yes.
And she left, if you're watching this tape, that means everything's gone wrong.
Right.
Kind of message.
I'm dead. Please do a thing for
me. Yeah. And this is another, kind of like the last Mission Impossible Rogue Nation. There's a secret syndicate out there, a shadow organization, mm-hmm. Known as Spectre.
Right.
And there's very little information about who's in it and who isn't. It's kind of Illuminati-esque. But they may or may not control everything, including all of the events that's happened in the previous films.
Right.
It seems to suggest that might be the case.
Yes.
And as he's going along, he runs into Lea Seydoux. But anyway, so he's trying to keep her alive because she's entangled in all this. And her father was a villain in, I think, Quantum of Solace, actually.
He was, yeah.
He's been offed by the syndicate, and so now they're like trying to survive all of this and put all the pieces together and blah 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 blah.
Right.
A lot of globetrotting.
A lot of
big special effects and a lot of big set pieces that take place in the centers and the hearts of all of these iconic cities around the world, like Rome and Mexico City. The really big single take that happens at the entrance of the movie.
That was cool.
A lot of big filmmaking.
Yeah, and I mean, I think also even more specifically, the key words in that sentence you just used is a lot, because this movie is a lot.
Yes.
There's a lot going on in this movie.
Yeah.
Not for, in my opinion, the better. I don't know. Am I allowed to leap into how I feel about this movie
yet? Oh,
go for
it, yes.
I really, can I curse? Is that
go
okay?
Go for it, yeah.
I really fucking hated it.
Really? Okay, interesting.
I fucking hated it, and I'm befuddled that there's any kind of positive reaction about it.
Hmm.
Not that there's overwhelming, it's pretty mediocre reviews, but it's going to make a lot of money, which, you know, cool. But
oof. Apparently it has, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Couldn't stand it. started very, very strong for me.
That first big set piece?
I liked the beginning of the first big set piece. It starts, it's got that very cool one take, which, you know, sometimes I feel is masturbatory, but I'm, you know, usually very interested by them. It's going on, we're following this masked dude who looks really cool.
A Day of the Dead celebration happening everywhere.
It's a great aesthetic.
It
looks awesome. And we get to Craig finally unmask himself, and he's with this gorgeous woman. He says, "I'll be right back." And he walks outside, goes and handles his business, blows up an entire city. But he never comes back, which drove me fucking crazy. And I thought, what a waste of a one-shot, because it was really just this really cool long take that leads with Craig moving through a crowd and up an elevator, and then he takes off his mask and he walks out of a window and he goes to spy on some people, and you're thinking, cool. And then it stops. And I thought, why was this a one take then?
Right.
If you were going to sell it as a one take with Bond money, I mean, I hear by the end the budget for this movie was close to $300 million.
That's believable. Based upon just everything you have to do in this movie.
And how ridiculously long it is and how many different sets there are. So why not let that one take continue longer? It stops when he sees the people he's spying on, and then it
Then it goes traditional coverage.
Yeah. Then it goes completely boring cinematography. And Hoyt von Hoytema, I'm pronouncing his name correctly, is a really great cinematographer and was absolutely underused in this film.
I kind of agree with that. I noticed immediately that it wasn't Roger Deakins anymore.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't look into it going into the movie. I assumed it was probably if Mendes was coming back, he would be along for the ride.
Right.
But he was probably doing Sicario. Yeah. And Hoytema, if we're pronouncing that correctly, he shot Her and mm-hmm. Left the Right One In.
Right.
Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy.
Interstellar.
Yeah.
He's great.
Yeah.
Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy. I was shocked that that didn't get more cinematography recognition because it's unbelievably well shot.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, gorgeous. He's great. He's very, very talented. And I don't know what went wrong here. I don't know if Mendes didn't allow things. Maybe Mendes doesn't really have a great eye for action. Maybe Hoyt didn't get to do what he wanted, or maybe just a blunder. You know, everyone makes something not great once in a while.
Right. I mean, I don't think the movie looks bad.
No, but
it's serviceable, but it doesn't look like a lauded cinematographer's work.
Yeah.
And maybe it's just by comparison of Skyfall.
Yeah.
But I don't know. And I think the set pieces here, they move so quickly and they're so cluttered mm-hmm. and there's so much going on in each one of them. They move from one thing to another. And a lot of it, I mean, I don't dislike it as much as you did. I think as far as Bond movies goes, it's pretty much par for the course. I think it's fine.
Yeah.
But a lot of it feels like Bond's greatest hits because we end up, you know, we have a big car chase in Rome that we've seen in a lot of Bond movies. And then we have him on ski slopes, which we've seen in Honor's Majesty's Secret Service. And, you know, like, it seems like, and I don't want to get too much into plot reveals, but even that kind of suggests this sort of nostalgia, I guess a way a lot of the fans felt about Star Trek Into Darkness, which is them sort of reimagining old Bond stories and kind of their own new, fresh take version of it.
Yeah, and we should have maybe gotten the hint from Skyfall, which I think is a really cool flick, and I really enjoy it. But I think looking back at it now, and I should rewatch it, I can kind of notice how the beats would turn into Spectre.
Right.
And maybe I dropped the ball on my part, having any kind of decent expectation of Spectre. Mm-hmm. I think, like you said, cluttered. Just unbelievably cluttered. Basically a collection of 5 to 10 minute scenes that barely had anything to do with one another.
Mm-hmm.
And I almost found it incoherent at times.
Pretty much excuses for him to go from one part of the globe to the other to do some giant big thing.
Yeah.
The
whole movie also, I feel, could have been shot silently and they could have done ADR and it would have been the same movie because everything visual was barely connected to story.
Mm-hmm.
It was almost constantly people telling each other what happened, but almost never doing anything. I don't want to spoil anything, but all of the reveals are very much just, oh, by the way, I did this. And you're like, how? What? When did that happen? He's like, oh, I did it earlier. You weren't there, but I did it.
Right.
fuck off. Come on. Show me something. This is a film, you know? If it were a book, maybe it would work, you know? But if I'm watching it and you have $300 million, show it to me. Don't just show me a bunch of random explosions and chases and then explain later.
Yeah, although the whole point of that 20 minutes is because I had to grab this thing or whatever it was. Yeah.
But even beyond that, I mean, the whole interconnected plots from trying to connect Casino Royale, Quantum, and Skyfall all together, mainly through villains.
Yeah, kind of clunkily done.
I mean, absolutely.
It
was tacked on and I don't even understand.
It's pretty much all explained in one monologue. It's like, these last four films is because of me!
Yeah, and how? Yeah. Why? What did you do? What could you possibly do? and Lechiffre as a villain is so great in Casino Royale, which is to me...
The Mads Mikkelsen character.
Yeah. I mean, Casino Royale is an unbelievably great film. It's one of those films I was so happy I was wrong about. Because when I saw the trailers, I was like, ugh, new James Bond. I like Pierce Brosnan. This is horseshit.
Right.
And I watched 5 minutes into the theater, or into the movie while I was in the theater. I was like, wow, this movie's fucking amazing. And I was so wrong. And I'm so happy I was so wrong. And with Spectre, I was like, I knew this wasn't going to be good. And I'm right. God damn it.
Is it an every other one thing? Is that, I mean, it kind of feels like that's sort of been the, the trend in Bond for pretty much ever.
I would have to have a list of all the Bond movies in front of me to affirm, but
it's
I
like totally the Star agree. Trek rule, you know, all the odd numbers or whatever.
Yeah, only the evens are good.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah, only the odd Bonds are good. Casino Royale's great, Quantum's bad, Skyfall's good, Spectre's bad. Let's see what happens next. I heard an interesting rumor about potentially what could be next, actually. And I don't believe it, but because this rights issue is so big with Bond right now, and it's about to go onto the market, and Sony presumably can't afford to keep it, the rumor is that Warner Brothers is going to snag it, because Warner Brothers had a pretty good year. Last year they had a great year. Not as good as Universal's year, but still very, very good.
Yeah.
And they're going to snag it. No one's wanted to do a Bond forever. He's going to take the Bond, and the rumor is Tom Hardy. I would be bummed if it were Tom Hardy. How would you feel?
I think he could do it. It would be a different Bond, for sure.
Totally.
I mean, I think Daniel Craig has already kind of grizzled the character quite a bit.
True.
And if they were to bring in Tom Hardy, it would probably do that even a little bit more. I've been saying since Dark Knight Rises, or no, even before that, I've been saying since Inception that essentially Christopher Nolan wants to make a Bond movie.
Yeah.
And he's trying to fit it into every project he's done since, with the exception of Interstellar.
Yeah.
But
he can't, because he's so tied to Warner Brothers. Rightfully so, because Warner Brothers treats him very well, and they're more committed, I think, than Sony to making interesting films. But Warner Brothers can't make a Bond movie yet, so... Part
maybe,
of the problem.
Maybe now they can.
Maybe now they can. I'm of the Idris Elba camp. I know it's like a very maybe overheard.
It's like the Donald Glover
for Spider-Man thing. Yeah, I never liked Donald Glover for Spider-Man, but I do. I love Donald Glover, but he was just never right for that role for me. He's too old for Miles Morales. But I would love the Elba. I just want a Black Bond. I get shit for it maybe, but I'd
be into it. I see no problem with that, and I think the character is. Different actors come in and reinterpret it a lot of different ways. But going back to this movie.
Right, sorry.
That's okay. What did you think of the Bond cast of characters that we have? We have the new Q played by...
Ben Whishaw,
yeah.
Right.
And the new Moneypenny and... are they still fun?
I'm going to throw back to the very first time I was on a podcast with you. And the only time, besides now, you and I were talking about Watchmen. We were debating it, and you said it was a cast of very fine actors doing their worst work.
Yeah.
And that was this for me. Because Craig is a great Bond.
Mm-hmm.
Ben Whishaw is an interesting Q. Ralph Fiennes is a really great actor.
Yeah.
And Naomi Harris is also really great. And so is Christoph Waltz, and so is Andrew Scott, and I like Dave Bautista, and every fucking character was so boring to me. Lisa Doe is a great actress. Monica Bellucci's a great actress.
Yeah.
And the wasted potential.
I completely forgot Monica Bellucci was in this movie until you just now said it out of your mouth.
And yet, it felt like they were pushing it as like, I remember this great quote from Daniel Craig, because he's a very cool guy, I believe. Someone was asking him, oh, how does it feel about Bond? Being seduced or seducing an older woman. How do you feel about that? And he said, well, you mean a woman my own age.
Right.
And I thought, yeah, Daniel Craig, kick ass. That's a good point. And I watched the movie, you get Monica Bellucci. I'm like, all right, cool. What's she going to do? She's kind of like this widow. She's maybe dangerous. What's happening? And then they bang.
She disappears out of the movie completely.
Completely gone.
Yeah.
Presumably survives, but like, who fucking knows?
Maybe, maybe not.
And then she's replaced by the half Bond's age love interest, which I couldn't believe they made her love interest. It was infuriating to me.
Right. It seemed out of nowhere. But like I said, I feel like everything here is very par for the course as far as Bond goes. And it seems like one of the aims of this movie wasn't just to play Bond's greatest hits, although that's a big part of it, but I think it was also to maybe lighten it up a little.
Right.
I think a lot of people were maybe a little upset. I mean, largely... the last three movies have done very well. But I think some people maybe miss some of the intentional camp that the Bond series has. And there was a little bit of it in Skyfall in comparison to the others. But this one, I think, really tries to bring it in like more one-liners and a slightly lighter tone. And I think the way him and Lea Seydoux's relationship kind of play out is very traditional Bond.
Yeah.
For better or worse.
It is until it stops being, though. Because I feel most Bond girls, they like Bond a lot, and they're infatuated by him, and they have intercourse with him, and then they, I think, by the end of the film, kind of accept they'll probably never see him again. But at the end of this film, there's a very strong implication that they're going to be, like, together forever.
Mm.
And I hated that for many reasons.
Well, there's reasons for that, I think.
Yeah?
Have you ever seen Honor Majesty's Secret Service?
No.
You should. It's one of the better Bond movies, and it's the only one that Lazenby played. He's not the best Bond by any means. Actually, he's kind of just filler as far as an actor goes. But I really like the setting of that one, and it takes place on Christmas. Totally weird.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway,
cool. Maybe we'll make it a Christmas movie.
All of the set pieces take place on a ski hill. it's sort of a little bit of like an origin story of why he's such a son of a bitch and why he's such a misogynist. So I think they might be playing that route. I'm not sure enough they've introduced this character, but
they already did that in Casino Royale, though.
They did.
I mean, yeah. And it was very effectively done. And I think Eva Green was an amazing Bond female. And I thought that relationship was great, and it gave context to his misogyny. And you kind of thought, all right, I can live with this, you know? And to just do it again and weaker is...
Right.
If you're going to do it again, you have to do it better, you know? Mm-hmm. It's like Spike Lee's Old Boy. I love Spike Lee, but if you're going to remake Old Boy, you have to try to make it better.
Or at least different.
Yeah, you can't make the same thing, but weaker. Because I'm not against remakes, I'm not against reboots, but you have to do it different and hopefully better.
Mm-hmm.
At least try to be better.
Yeah.
Don't do it the same, but weaker. I think that's where this failed in a lot of aspects for me.
Yeah. I'll definitely give you cluttered and overlong. I think the movie could desperately need like a half hour edited out. It's way too long.
Oh, yeah. I mean, what hurts, you could pull out half hour anywhere, and it wouldn't really change anything because it's so non-connected.
Right.
Despite being a movie that's all about everything being connected. The whole movie itself is completely incoherent to me. Very unconnected. Christoph Waltz is absolutely wasted.
You know, I find myself saying that a lot about Christoph Waltz, though.
Yeah.
Like, he's great in the Tarantino flicks,
mm-hmm.
but can you really point out a non-Tarantino performance in his American films that are, like, anywhere near that good? Or, I always walk away from a Christoph Waltz performance out of a Tarantino film where I feel like, where's that thing that I fell in love with?
Right. I mean, I thought it felt like, I feel like I'm just getting Christoph Waltz light now and everything.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard he was good in Zero Theorem, though I've heard the movie's terrible. I have not seen it.
I didn't see it.
I love Green Hornet.
Really?
I know. It's super bad.
You're the one?
I'm the one person. I saw that movie and thought, this is cool. I enjoy this. I don't know. Something about, I think the aesthetic was interesting. Michelle Gondry kind of had an interesting quality to it.
I'd say it was like okay and Big Eyes. I mean, it's everything in that movie was like just kind of okay. I don't know. I thought, and as far as what he has to do here and the character that he sort of ends up revealing himself to be, it makes sense. It's fine. I think when we were doing the movie news about a year ago, and the news we were presenting was Christoph Waltz is going to be in a Bond movie.
Yeah.
I think my first question to my other co-host was a little too on the nose.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think anyone was...
Could they give him a hook and an eye patch?
Yeah. I mean, this is the thing. To follow up Javier Bardem, who's an unbelievable actor and did a great job in Skyfall, Silva was really interesting. To follow that up, you need someone with gravitas who's very good.
Yeah.
And Christoph Waltz has the potential, I think, to be a good follow-up. And especially with what they were trying to do with him, the potential was all there. And I think a really lazy script, a really incoherent film, a really phoned-in performance by him,
mm-hmm.
some good makeup towards the end on him, I thought looked cool. But just in general, it was just a recipe for a weaker film. And to then also, this is what I found like slightly offensive about it, to then go back and say Lechiffre and Silva and whoever the dude from Quantum of Solace was, who's not that great. But to say that all these people are connected to the bad of... Spectre,
mm-hmm.
to me, undermines them. It makes them seem like they couldn't work for themselves.
Right.
And if you wanted to bring in this interconnected idea, don't weaken the other movies, too. You know, I thought Casino Royale does a really good job of weakening Lechiffre within itself by the end of the film. But Skyfall has very continued stance on Silva being a very dangerous and interesting person who's very maniacal and fascinating. Yeah. And to undermine him, I found it very offensive. Sam Mendes just undermined his own movie. Why would you do that?
Yeah, I kind of agree with that. I don't know if it's entirely Mendes' fault, given that, it, you know.
Totally fair.
The screenplay had a lot to do with it. And I would say that it is a very weak screenplay.
Totally.
It's definitely the worst part about the movie. And I felt like the Christoph Waltz character, he maybe doesn't give the best performance, but he also isn't given a lot to do. Like, literally, if you count his minutes on screen, he's not in it very much. He's kind of alluded to for a lot of it. Let's put our film studies hat on for a little bit.
Okay, I'll see if it still fits.
Subtextually, there's this thing going on in here that it's not even really subtext. It's pretty overt about the NSA and spying and drones and how this technology is going to take over the need for manned operations. And there's this whole thing, like, the Ralph Fiennes character is being, his whole 007 program, or his 00 program is being threatened to be basically cut in favor of this interconnected wireless spying stuff.
Right.
Do you think any of that matters? Do you think any of that really plays into the overall themes of the movie? Or do you think it was kind of shoehorned in there? Are we supposed to really be that paranoid by it? And sub question.
Okay.
Do you think that Captain America: Winter Soldier already did all of that much better?
Well, yes. Sub question answered. Done. I think it might have been shoehorned in. I do personally believe that films like action films and sci-fi films and horror films are their most interesting when they're trying to say something.
Yeah.
And even if it's not that strong of a message, you know, something simple like don't be an asshole is still something. And I find films I hesitate to say this, but it's a personal belief that films kind of have a responsibility to do that, especially in the sci-fi.
Yeah.
And
be about something.
Yeah, to say something. It's why Invasion of the Body Snatchers is one of my favorite films of all time. It tries to say something. Now, what it says is debatable. It's very some people think it's pro-Marxist or anti-Marxism. Some people think it's anti-McCarthyism.
Yeah. And
to me, that's great because we can fight about it. You know, that's what's awesome. And it's trying to say something, and it's saying something worth talking about. And this movie's trying to say something. Maybe it's shoehorned in, but it doesn't do anything interesting. Actually, by the end of the film, I kind of thought if the head of all this evilness wasn't such a prick, he'd be right. I didn't find any really strong, compelling arguments for why the 00 program should stay.
Right. Especially in following Bond's activities. If you go through all of the movies, not even just the Craig movies, but all of them, and count the millions of wasted dollars on collateral damage alone, it's a huge waste of money.
I mean, he blows up a whole block in Mexico in the beginning of the film. And he has that line. They say, you blew up a block in Mexico. And he's like, well, it's better than a stadium. And I was like, was it? Was it really much better than a stadium? It seems similar. But I think your job is to kill no one. I don't think it's like, well, I killed less people.
Right.
But as far as the anti-NSA stuff goes, you know, I don't love the NSA. I'm not super into the whole spying on people in your own country thing. Mm. So I think it's maybe trying to say.
I think if there is kind of a socio-political message here, it's that if we decide as a world that this is the way we want to go, and everything's going to be connected through computers, and everything's going to be spyable, and we're just going to have to trust that governments kind of cooperate on this, that it would take very little for one bad guy or one evil organization to hack in and screw everyone over.
Yeah.
That, you know, as soon as you connect everything, and then it makes that thing easier to take over.
Yeah.
I thought that was vaguely interesting, although I thought that the movie wasn't as concerned with it as it wanted us to think it was.
Not at all. I mean, it wasn't a good enough film for me to think about what it's trying to say.
Anyway.
But you're right, yeah. You know, it's vaguely interesting.
Yeah. Although, I do think that a lot of this was already covered in Captain America: Winter Soldier.
Right.
Quite a bit more effectively.
I mean, if we just put those two movies, this movie and Winter Soldier.
Structurally, they're very similar.
Yeah, there's a lot of similar beats going on.
Spectre and Hydra are essentially the same thing. They even have the same mascot.
Right, an octopus.
Right.
And yet, Winter Soldier, in almost every front, is a far superior film. With worse actors, believe it, like, strangely enough. It's got a worse cast. Quotes worse, but...
Right.
But...
Not as prestige, not as prestige. Whatever.
I mean, it's got directors who've done almost nothing. You Mean Dupree is a very cool film.
Yeah.
But, like, pretty new directors. And yet, on every front, is better than a Bond movie, which is shocking, I think, in a lot of ways. The fight choreography is something I could complain about with Spectre all day. And I think that's part of why I wanted to do, like, Five Venoms and stuff like that for our secondary conversation.
Yeah.
Because fight choreography, to me, in action films is extremely important. And... it was so boring, Inspector. And people were talking about the train fight being really good, and I just thought it was not good.
It was fine. I'm remembering it now that you mentioned it, but it didn't, like, stay on me as I was leaving the theater, like, oh man, that train fight. It, to me, it was, everything about that movie is so more is more.
Right.
That I, not one set piece really, other than maybe the first one, because it was my first impression of the movie.
Right.
Nothing really, like, stuck with me. I think the problem is if your movie is just, like, one giant climax the whole time, then it levels everything the same.
Yeah, if your movie is loud the entire time, no one notices when it gets loud.
Yeah.
A sound designer said that. I don't know who. But a good one.
It's true, though. And it's true. In, you know, not in just sound design, but in effects, in action sequences.
Right.
And, the only time you really notice... when it's not like that, it's when the movie just completely lulls in between those things.
Right. It's a very boring movie in a lot of areas, I thought.
Yeah. And I guess maybe I wasn't the best judge because so many of these movies leave me feeling the same way, except for the great ones.
Right.
So I thought maybe it was, like I said, like, it's a Bond movie.
Right.
Bond people will probably like it. I don't know. Maybe they won't.
Yeah, no. I mean, I've heard that, a lot of people are like, oh, this is exactly what I wanted from a Bond movie. And I was like, but I don't like hiding behind that excuse.
Right. You know? I agree with you.
I think we can hold movies to higher standards than their failed predecessors.
Yeah.
We don't have to live in mediocrity.
Yeah, agreed. Okay, well, let's go ahead and get into the Five Venoms then, since you brought it up.
Okay.
And I'll let you set that up. What happens in the Five Venoms?
Yeah, sure. An aging teacher, kung fu master, teaching his students. He meets up with his final student as he's dying and informs him that his original five students, each based on a type of animal that has a poison gland, can poison you and kill you, they're all potentially unsavory fellows.
Mm-hmm.
And this new student needs to track them down, watch their movements, make sure they're good. If they're not good, he needs to defeat them. In order to defeat them, he'll need the help of one of them because he's not strong enough to do it himself by his lonesome.
Right.
And so this new student goes and tries to track down his five potential enemies. There was the centipede, the snake, the scorpion, the lizard, and the toad.
Yep.
Is that right?
Yep.
All right. Yeah, and... you know, we slowly figure out who is who. It's all a mystery. No one really knows who these people are. It's a very hidden organization.
Well, there's also, like, there's kind of a convoluted thing that's explained at the beginning. It's like, three of them know who each other are.
Right.
The other two know who the other two are. And the scorpion, nobody knows who he is.
Right. One and two know each other, but three and...
There's some interesting board game rules.
Yeah, it was...
To the plot coming...
what'd you think? What'd you think of it?
I enjoyed it. I enjoyed the fight choreography the most, obviously. This is a Shaw Brothers joint. This came out in 1978. A lot of people maybe haven't seen a lot of those movies or any of them. But essentially, if you've seen the Kill Bill movies, they're riffing on Shaw Brothers movies for the most part.
Right.
A little bit of Spaghetti Western as well, but... largely the Shaw Brothers stuff. So like those quick zooms in and those big exaggerated wire foo set pieces and that kind of stuff. It all comes from them. And there's a lot of great stuff in here doing that. I was really surprised actually by how plot oriented it ended up being.
Yeah.
Maybe slightly to the movie's detriment. Because usually when you enter a movie that's the five this or the seven that or whatever.
It's the five a lot, weirdly, in Kung Fu. Five Deadly Venoms, five Shaolin Masters.
Yeah.
It's very frequently five. There must be some more interesting.
I thought it was going to be a little bit more kind of a straightforward kind of tournament style thing,
right.
Where he has to go and, you know, quote unquote, defeat each one and find their weakness and defeat them. And right. It ended up being kind of the, like a little bit of like this like political thriller almost,
yeah.
Kind of in the middle where you have this like this. These people, some of them were involved in the government that's going on in this village, and yeah. And they're trying to overthrow each other and kind of playing this like house of cards against each other. And then he kind of the main protagonist who sort of disappears in and out of the movie for various yeah. times. He sort of kind of gets caught up in the middle of this, and really, maybe in a slightly kind of Yojimbo way, he can kind of just sit back and let them destroy each other.
It's almost. He's almost like a Mad Max figure, where he can yeah. pretty much sit on the side and watch until he doesn't have to anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
he's learning for the first hour of the movie. He's not
yeah.
acting, which I thought was interesting.
Seeing how all the dominoes are set up.
Yeah,
yeah.
He's not gonna just jump in blind. It's meticulous. I don't know if you're into Wu-Tang Clan at all.
Not entirely, but I know that they're super into this stuff.
Yeah, they're yeah. very into this. The RZA. One of the Wu-Tang Clan members,
right?
And also Man with the Iron Fist. He has an interesting quote that he took from an old kung fu movie, but I don't remember the movie, so we'll say the RZA said it.
Okay.
And it's that the lotus grows from the mud, and it's basically this idea that from the schlockier films, the films that maybe time has forgotten a little bit, that were passed as garbage, beauty and incredible knowledge can spill from them,
right.
grow from them, and
which has essentially been Tarantino's career model.
Yeah, I mean, the
yeah.
Tarantino model, and I think in general, there's been this new resurgence of remixing the old into, I mean, even Spike Lee remade Ganja and Hess, you know?
Yeah.
Edgar Wright, you know, a big student of the Tarantino style, but
yeah.
in his own right, loves schlock and moves together in interesting mm. ways. You're Next, and people like who are into The Guest and things of that style.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Or even It Follows and a lot of that stuff
yeah.
kind of ripping on exploitation movies in one way or another.
Yeah, I mean, It Follows would be non-existent.
Like a Carpenter-esque
exactly,
kind
without
of thing.
Carpenter.
Yeah.
And there were elements of this film that I thought... There were elements of this film that paved the path to really interesting newer films, too.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm fascinated by that journey. There's a Matrix move. I don't know if you caught that. Where the very famous bullet dodge from Matrix 1, where he flips
yeah.
backwards and he's on his
yeah. on his knees essentially.
Yeah,
yeah.
Like yeah, and it turns himself into like an R.
Right.
That was thrown into here too.
Mm-hmm.
There was a very interesting amount.
But the Wachowskis have always ripped. Well, not always, but specifically the Matrix movies are totally informed by Hong Kong filmmaking.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And there was this very cool line in this film. You know, you to find the lotus, you have to sift through a lot of mud sometimes. But there was one line in this film, something along the lines of silver, you can bury a lot under silver, which I thought was really interesting. And it was talking about police corruption, which is a big theme in this film. Even one of the ultimately good guys was a slightly corrupt police officer
right.
in the beginning. And this idea that people are just buying their way to the police was
uh-huh.
fascinating to me, especially now. I mean, Tarantino and so many stories of police brutality and police corruption. To see it in this film is really interesting for me.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and it kind of sets up that world building really well, where that everyone is corrupt kind of thing.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, largely been a trope of, you know, film noir and gangster films, as well as westerns and that kind of stuff, but all kind of uses those kind of tropes where, you know, and it also in this story in particular, it aids in that, like the protagonist, we have to learn about all these characters and what their allegiances are or aren't. And it's kind of difficult at the beginning to know who's to be trusted and who isn't, because
right.
everyone's kind of a son of a bitch.
True. And it's, you know, it's a movie about poisoning to an extent.
Mm-hmm.
And I think poisoning via money was another element of it. I almost wish it was called The Six Venoms, because then you'd be like, what's a Six Venom? Money? Yeah, maybe a little too on the nose. But
no, that's good. I like it.
But I thought it was, yeah, I really enjoyed it. I really like Shaw
yeah.
Brothers films. I'm very into them. I ended up buying a box set of about 25 of them, all Wu-Tang related, because I'm a big Wu-Tang Clan fan as well. I think Shaw Brothers films, their choreography is so fascinating. And always different, even when they feel familiar. I never felt like they've recycled from themselves. They're always pushing what we can handle and believe. You know, you have the lizard who can stand on walls.
Right.
And, you know, of course, no one is so good at Kung Fu that they can stand on walls. But you always believe the actors are as good as their characters are.
There's a mythical element to a lot of their movies. And, you know, all the wire work and that kind of stuff that plays into the fight choreography. It kind of makes it believable. You know, it's kind of easy to take for granted now in a post Crouching Tiger world that we live in. I think a lot of people, that was their first interaction with this type of stuff, was that film. And a lot of people are kind of blown away by the idea of like people flying on roofs and stuff. It's like, you know, these movies have existed since like the mid 60s or even earlier.
When we were in Korea, I saw a very cool one. That was a ripoff of ones that were even older than that, but it was made from the 60s. And it was The General's Son or something like that. Mm. And it was another one with like really interesting choreography. And I think I feel like I'm pretty good at naming people who are in things, and I have a very hard time remembering people who are in older Shaw Brothers films, you know, as far as the actors' names or the performers' names. And I think part of that adds to the believability of their characters, is because I've recognized people being in multiple films, but I always believe that they can do everything they do.
Right.
Even when it's ridiculous, like standing on a wall, I still believe, well, you know what? If that guy tried really hard, I bet he could pull it off. A couple seconds.
Right, yeah.
Just long enough for the shot.
Well, when I was a kid, you know, watching all these different animes and stuff where it's just a given that people can fly or people can do all this stuff.
Right.
It's like, at one point, some monk must have done something that was just amazing for this to enter into their cultural lexicon.
Did you see the guy run on water last year? A guy ran the furthest on water anyone's ever run. And he has these little things he's stepping on, but essentially he's running on water. And he runs across a lake or a river, and it's mind-blowing. And you're like, this guy did this. Anything Jackie Chan has ever done, you know?
Yeah.
And I think
a really, really good fighter like that, or it's almost more like dancing, really. They can make it look so effortless what they're doing, even though there's a lot of physical exertion in it. I remember Tony Jaa, who's from Thailand.
Yeah.
His whole goal was to do wire work without wires.
Wow.
That was his, when he entered into the film world, that was what he wanted to do. He's like, I want to do what normal people had to do on wires, but without.
Wow. That's amazing. I need to watch more. I've seen
the Ong Bak movies and The Protector. Yeah.
Yeah. He's great. He's really good. Him and Michael Jai White and Scott Adkins. Scott Adkins is an unbelievable performer who never really gets mainstream stuff, but he's very good.
Yeah.
Jackie Chan being one of the greatest entertainers of all time, in my opinion. But I think it stems from this believability and seeing someone and believing they're doing all the stuff they're doing. And I think James Bond and a lot of modern films like that, I don't believe as much. I do believe Daniel Craig can do a lot of his own stunts, and I believe he does.
Yeah.
And I believe he can probably fight pretty decently.
Yeah.
But
Tom Cruise has been very vocal about doing his own stunts and
Tom Cruise is a unnatural. He's unbelievable.
Right.
He can do stunts that I think Jack Chan go, all right, hang on a second.
We're going to hang you on the side of this building.
Yeah. I mean, Jackie's done that too, though. But they're both top tier entertainers. Personal opinions aside, political opinions aside, perhaps. And Spectre and Five Venoms, where I think I prefer a film like Five Venoms is in its believability. When I watch it, I think these are people fighting. And when I watch Spectre, I think these are people doing choreography.
Right.
And the train scene being a good example of felt very choreographed. And a bunch of moments that could have happened that didn't. You know, there weren't any payoffs. Something that's cool about old kung fu films like Five Venoms is there's a build. You know, you're taught what they have to do to defeat the bad guy, and then you get to watch them try to do it, and it's a payoff. You know, you get a big finish, and Spectre's big finish was very boring
to me. Right.
In one part in the scene, Inspector, he has the ice pick, and I'm thinking, cool, what's going to happen here? What is going to be the cool big payoff with the ice pick? And it's nothing, you know?
Right.
But in Five Deadly Venoms, when you see an Iron Maiden, there's a payoff. You know, you yeah. see something happen with it. When you see any of the torture devices, there's
well, a payoff. And they have story purpose too. Yeah. I think one of the big things about action films, in particular martial arts films, is that they're almost kind of like musicals, in that each fight sequence is like a big musical number, and it should get you from one part of the story to the other.
Right.
It should be moving story along as well as entertaining you with fight choreography. And this movie certainly does that. And all of the fights have a lot of stakes in them because, as we mentioned before, it's all tied into this people exposing each other and, you know, House of Cards, Game of Thrones, whatever you want to call it, this right. political stuff going on within this group of people. Whereas in Spectre, it's, you know, it's like a lot of big budget American style action films nowadays. It's just a lot of stuff to fill out a block of time.
Right. And sell watches.
Right. Yeah. to keep you paying attention or keep you awake. By, you know, blowing up as much stuff around you
yeah,
as possible.
Yeah, I mean, absurd explosions.
Right.
And like we said before, when you see it nonstop, you're not interested by it anymore.
Yeah, it becomes numbing. It hits a maximum capacity, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I can watch entire city blocks explode in Spectre and go, oh, yeah, whatever. But then I can watch one dude bend metal with his elbow in Five Venoms. Oh, my God. That was amazing. Did you see that?
Right.
And like I said, part of it's believability, but also it's knowing when to bend the metal and when to not. You know, you have to be able to know when to pull the punches and when to show everything.
Yeah.
Five Venoms being...
And to give everything a story purpose.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Totally, totally. And I think that's why, like, that RZA quote that I'm very fascinated by, you know, the lotus grows from the mud. That's why I'm more interested right now in sifting through mud. Direct-to-DVD films are big for me right now.
Yeah.
I love them. Or old films that I feel like maybe aren't getting as much recognition, you know, mm-hmm. that have been passed off as too cheesy. The blood's too red, it doesn't look real. Fuck you.
Right. Yeah.
I'll take cheesy blood and great choreography over great blood and shite choreography, you know? I love the less loved market. I think that's where you really get to thrive in one area. You know, even if the story's mediocre, the
yeah.
choreography is amazing. And I'll take that.
Yeah.
For my action films.
And I was looking on here, you know, every time the movie ends or whatever, it always gives you suggestions of what to watch next.
Yeah.
And there's actually a good number of Shaw Brothers movies and other Hong Kong-style action
yeah.
films that are on there. So if people end up watching this and like it,
yeah.
there you can, you know, you can get your Shaw on
yeah.
and explore.
Return to the 36th Chamber. I also got a shout out Ninja 2, Shadow of a Tear.
Yeah.
For some reason, Ninja 1's not on Netflix, but Ninja 2 is a newer film from 2013 or 14, I think. Scott Adkins, direct-to-DVD movie about a guy who is a ninja. And it's absolutely fantastic.
That's fun? It's
yeah,
fun?
It's really fun. I gotta give shout-outs to films like that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's pretty much the show.
Right on.
Thanks for doing this with me.
Yeah, man. Thanks for having me.
And I like that we were able to kind of, you know, to talk about, you know, the movies, obviously, but we also were able to kind of pull in a bigger... we usually have a section in this podcast called the pet topic where we kind of talk about these kind of things.
Hmm.
And I felt like there was kind of a pet topic that ran throughout.
Interwoven.
Perhaps. Yes. It was yeah. in there. It's buried under the review stuff.
It was just like Spectre.
yeah, it's all connected.
Yeah. Involved from the beginning.
Where can people find you if they want to follow you on Twitter? Do you have a blog? Anything you want to pimp?
I have a Twitter. You're more than welcome to follow it. I don't tweet that much. It's just my name. Alec Angerson. A-L-E-C. E-N-G-E-R-S-O-N. You can find me on Facebook if you want to be my friend.
Okay.
No pressure.
Well, cool. And if you said you were flirting with the idea of starting a podcast.
I am. Yeah, it's actually that actually has a Twitter too, but there's nothing on it because it doesn't,
oh, okay.
it doesn't, it's called Halfway to Halfway. Kind of my
good name.
I thought it was a good name.
Good start.
I think
yeah.
it works on multiple levels. You know,
better than where we started.
We're halfway to middle age, I think. We're also halfway to the madhouse. I thought it was an interesting title.
Yeah.
I shouldn't probably sell it and tell everyone what the title means because it's less interesting, but they'll have to listen to this to get that.
Sure. Well, when that gets started, maybe we can direct people to your show or
yeah,
whatever.
Yeah, maybe
we'll
do like a crossover
event.
Yeah, crossovers. That'd be great. Thanks, man.
You're welcome. And if anybody wants to talk about anything that we talked about on this show, or you want to give us your thoughts or comments about Spectre or the Five Venoms or any of the movie news, any of the movies we're going to talk about next week, which I've already forgot what Richard assigned me 2 weeks ago, so I have to... It has some really bizarre long name. It's a horror film we were supposed to do in October, but...
Interesting.
You can do so. Reach us at our email at jabberinthedrone@gmail.com. And we'll read it on air. You can also find us on Facebook, like I mentioned before, facebook.com/jabberpodcast. Follow us on Twitter @jabberpodcast, all one word. You can find us on Stitcher and iTunes and player.fm, which I didn't, and player.fm is new. It's a lot like Stitcher, and I didn't know what it was. I kind of just signed up with it because I saw it on a few other podcast pages.
Right.
Half of our listens are coming from that now. So that was like one of the best decisions I ever made.
What? Who? All right. I always had a question about this podcast. Who is Jabber and who is the drone? Are you the drone or Jabber?
Richard sort of came up with the name. I think I'm the drone. You're unfortunately, the drone.
So he's jabbering.
Yeah. I guess he's a little bit more. Yeah, I'm a little bit more of the Eeyore, and he's a little bit more of the Tigger.
Okay, Tigger's an American hero, so I appreciate
I'll take it.
Yeah.
What else? Oh, you can read my movie reviews that I do weekly for the Idaho State Journal at saladforkreviews.blogspot.com. What else? Oh, Richard has a blog that he never types anything into ever, rdwally.weebly.com. You can read some of the stuff I do for the Seattle-based entertainment site, MacGuffin, at mcguff.in/author/Cassidy. Listen to Brad, Amanda, and Alyssa's podcast, Quarter Life Crisis, at quartercrisis.podbean.com, which you've done an episode with.
I did. If you're fascinated by my jabbering, you can go find that old.
Right. I think that's like episode 8 of theirs, like from a couple years ago.
Yeah.
Also, be sure to listen to our friend Leland over in Olympia, Washington, at his comedy podcast, dampercast.com, and listen to our friends Patrick and his father at Make Dad Read Comics over in Detroit. You should listen to that podcast. It's great.
That's a great title.
We did a guest on theirs a couple weeks ago.
Yeah.
Yeah, Make Dad Read Comics. That was enough to draw me in.
Yeah, it's great.
And it's exactly what you want it to be.
Yo, yes.
And he also does another podcast with his teacher friend called Almost Educational, and I'm going to be a guest on that here pretty soon. Richard just did an episode with them talking about serial killers. So
cool.
And I think that's it.
All right, man.
So we'll probably have you on at some other point. But thanks for coming on.
Thanks, man. Appreciate it.